The American experience is not the same for all people, especially for people of darker skin hue, says today's guest. Dr. Neil Hall, doctor as an ophthalmologist and surgeon, met with great success in his life. He is a doctor, after all, but that success has been tempered by the way society continues to treat African Americans. For all our talk of equality in America, Neil Hall found plenty of evidence that it is still more talk than reality. He puts his feelings into poetry. Dr. Neil Hall holds degrees from Cornell and Harvard Universities. He is an ophthalmologist, an eye doctor, and surgeon, capable of treating eye problems medically and surgically. He's got one book of poetry already published and others in the works. His first book, Nigger for Life, won several awards, including the 2012-13 Los Angeles Book Festival Grand Prize. Neil Hall, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
So your upbringing in Warren, Ohio, what was that like? What were race relations like in those days in that town?
For me, and I can only speak from my perspective, I was sort of not aware of it at all because, one, I wasn't socialized or taught to look for it. I didn't know how to look for those kinds of things. But more importantly, there was this strong sense of acceptance because I was an athlete and performed at a very high level. So whatever racial things that are out there, but it may not have been as obvious to me for those very reasons. One, I wasn't looking for it. I didn't know how to look for it. And two, it was not that overt in my face because I was this athlete that was well-liked.
And when you're breaking records in your track events and stuff, people aren't...
Everybody loved you.
Right. So did your parents have to go through some struggles in their own lives with racism?
Again, that my dad wasn't around, but my mother was. And that was not the kind of thing that she even talked about. I don't even know how aware she was of it. I'm quite sure she was. But it wasn't the kind of thing that she talked about in the house. She was just so busy trying to provide that... We never had those kinds of discussions, and I never heard her have those kinds of discussions with her friends.
So from school or from news media or from any other sources, I mean, were you aware of racial struggles in America? Were you aware of the civil rights movement of the 60s and all that?
Well, I must admit, I was not in tune to much.
Really?
At all. I do remember sitting in my grandmother's living room when Martin Luther King was killed, and I was wondering, what is all... The fuss is about, and this must be something really important. But other than that, it was mostly playing outdoors with my friends, and then once I knew I wanted to go to college, it was about playing sports to get to college.
And your undergraduate work was at Cornell, is that right?
Cornell. Mm-hmm.
And you were a big track star there?
Football, I don't know how big that was, but football and track. I was recruited for football, and track was the thing I really loved.
But you were All-America in track, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
All right, so we can assume the big goes in front of that then. So where were the first experiences then? I mean, where would you first begin to learn that black people were treated differently?
I think where I really started to begin to see something was in my training at in Boston. It was my internship. I had a number of patients that refused to be seen by me, to my surprise. And then when I was at Harvard, I had a couple of patients that, again, refused to be seen by me and wanted to be seen by a white doctor. The other thing I started noticing was that for every strange, weird, tropical, just disease that one would think, oh, I don't want to be associated with that at all, it seemed to be projected on a black face when we were learning medicine. And I just thought that was odd. I'm not saying that's what they were doing, but I'm just saying it just seemed odd to me that every weird disease seemed to be projected on the black face to us. And so I started thinking a little bit about that. I think where it really hit me was when I tried to open my practice. I knew I always wanted to work for myself. I did not want to work anyone else's practice or economic infrastructure. I wanted my own. And how difficult that was, despite the amount of training I had, how difficult that was. And even to the point where I was trying to purchase a building and a gentleman told me that he had an obligation to his community not to sell the building to me, and it was a primarily white community. I noticed in the hospitals that, particularly when I would come out of surgery sometimes, I would immediately be told to go and mop OR number 3, or could I transport a patient somewhere? Or when I was doing a consult on a patient, how the other doctors would come in and just immediately cut me off in the middle of my consult, bedside consult, because they assumed that I was transport and that I was not a physician.
Just because you were black. It was like, oh, this is the guy who cleans the OR. This is the guy who shoves the patients down the hall. All right. Much more to talk about with Dr. Neil Hall. He is a poet and he is a surgeon as well. He has an appearance in Ashland tonight at 6 p.m. at Mix Downstairs. This is Mix on the Plaza, M-I-X, with Craig Wright, John Fisher-Smith. And this is called The Rogue Rights, 6 o'clock at Mix tonight. But we'll talk more with Neil Hall here and now on the Jefferson Exchange after a short break, and take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Exchange with Dr. Neil Hall and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Neil Hall, calls himself surgeon poet. He's an ophthalmologist and surgeon, eye doctor in other words, and eye surgeon, and also a poet, writing about his experiences achieving the pinnacle of success in a number of realms, but also being black in America and finding out that that puts limits on it, or at least white people will put limits on you if you're black in America. A lot of anger comes out in the poetry. It's very plain-spoken stuff. His published collection is called Nigger for Life. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking, Neil, about what it was like. This was even in Harvard Medical School that you were?
Yes.
People were just assuming because you were black, you were the guy who scrubbed out the ORs and stuff.
Yes.
How did you set people straight?
Well, first I had to set myself straight. I had to sort of come to grips with that. What is that? How does that make me feel? How am I going to respond to that? And early on, what I would do is I would just go and mop the floor.
Really?
And nurses that knew me then would say, what are you doing in here? And I would say, well, I'm mopping the floor because Nurse X said, go mop the floor. And then you would get that, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. And that's what I call nigger, Mr. Nigger response. And you would hope that in that exchange there would be some level of growth where people would make those kinds of assumptions just based on skin color and gender. Because this is really not just about skin color. This is about all the differences that we create in and amongst each other to find some kind of competitive socioeconomic advantage. So it's really not just about color. Since I am the one who bears the color, I speak from that perspective. But I'm quite sure women can speak from their perspective, and people who are of a certain age can speak from another perspective, and people of certain sexual orientations can speak from their perspective. And that's the sad thing about this.
That everybody gets to oppress somebody else in a sense?
Everybody gets to first find a way to distinguish themselves from their brother or sister in order to do that. That's the really sad thing about all this.
At what point did you start writing poetry then? I mean, was it always there and just something that sharpened its edge as you got further into medical school? Or
I did a little bit in high school, a little bit in college, but nothing major. I think it started more when I was a kid. I was very sensitive as a kid, but I grew up in a family of athletes, and they were very tough, and you didn't talk about emotions and things like that. So the page was where I would go. So years later, when it finally came to me that despite all that I did in terms of education and things like that, I was still judged first and foremost on the color of my skin. My capabilities were all judged first on my skin color. So I had to take that someplace. And so I went back to where I was when I was a kid. I went back to the page and I started writing on the page. And it started out sort of like a diary. And then I happened to share it with someone and they said, whoa, you should, this is a book. No, it's not a book. And it started from there.
And it became a book in
2009. And it became a book.
And that's when Nigger for Life came out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I need to let our listeners know, this is not a word we use lightly every day, but this is the word that Neil Hall chooses to use in his work, and we go there with him.
And I use that because I live that every day. And so I'm not going to hide behind it or the N word. I'm going to live the reality that that I live and speak about that. I thought about this, and I do it from a physician's perspective, in that if someone comes to me with a wound on their leg, it is my job to look squarely at that wound. It could be pus-filled, awful, smelly, but it's my job to look squarely at that wound, to come up with the right diagnosis, to come up with the right treatment, to cure it. And unless we do that, unless we are willing as human beings and brothers to do that, then we're never going to come up with the right diagnosis and thus the right solution to our problems.
So being honest about what lies before you is all it gets down to. Do you want to read one of your poems? We can give people an idea of what your work is like.
Sure. It's called My Name, in honor of my friend who helped me come here today. I pledge allegiance to a fully masked, half-flaccid flag, and to the republic which stands not, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I have prayed your Lord's Prayer to your God, made in your image, to deliver me from your evils. But hallowed be his name, no will for black prayer to be done on this earth, nor as it is in his gated heaven. I have given you my soul. Leave me my name. After all my toils, frets, and fears, suffered 2 score and 17 years, all my blood, sweat, and tears poured into every valley you forsaken me in, I've sung my country 'tis of thee. When you said sing, I have at your twilight's last gleaming held your broad stripes and bright stars waving over land you proclaimed to be free and home of the brave, not yet brave enough to let all men be free. I have given you my soul. Leave me my name. I believe your claim that Columbus, with certain navigational precision, sailed west to find India sitting in the east and discovered a continent not lost nor looking to be found, inhabited by men not lost nor looking to be found, and renamed them a new name other than their own. I have given you my soul. Leave me my name, 'cause if freedom comes a calling and I have no name to be called, how will I be freed? Leave me my name. I believed your lie that Washington never told a lie, that it was a civil war fought by civil men to free uncivilized slaves that Lincoln, without fraught, presided over so that this nation could claim yet a second new birth of freedom, a second new claim to be a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. To these yet unfinished and abandoned words and work, I have given you my soul. Leave me my name, 'cause when freedom comes a-calling, and I have no name to be called, how will I be freed? I have given you my soul. Leave me my name.
My Name is the name of the poem by Dr. Neil Hall, the surgeon poet here on the Jefferson Exchange. Well done, Neil. Thanks for that. Neil Hall will be appearing tonight in Ashland at the Rogue Rights. That'll be 6 p.m. at the Mix Restaurant in Ashland, downstairs portion, appearing with Craig Wright and John Fisher Smith. But you can talk to Neil here and now on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Neil Hall.
Dr. Hall, congratulations on the success in your life. Congratulations on writing powerful, powerful poetry. As I've been sitting here, I've been contemplating what I wanted to say, and frankly, Doctor, bigotry is generational in its nature. And in our household, in my family, my father taught us that that the color of a person's skin makes absolutely no difference. The measure of a person is how they live and how they behave. And that came down from his father, and it has been passed down through me, through the people I come into contact with. Does bigotry still exist? Absolutely. I've sat down with bigots and have been horrified by and dismayed by what I've seen and heard. Are we moving back towards Jim Crow? I think there are people who'd love to see that happen. But just a comment. I apologize for those people, and there are those of us who are doing our best. That's all I have to say.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much, but I don't think you need to apologize, but I do appreciate that. I deeply, deeply appreciate that, but I don't think you need to apologize. I know that there are good people everywhere, and it is generational. I think what happens is that we're socialized. This is all about economics, and we had this discussion off air. This is all about economics, and in many cases, what is taught, the goodness that's taught generational, is either muted, tempered by the economic reality in the workplace and other places like that, which gets one to not do the right thing or not fight against the wrong things. And so Martin Luther King said, and he said, it's not the strident clamor of the bad people, but it is the appalling silence of the good people. And that's what's really killing us. It is the appalling silence of the good people who claim to be the moral majority. And if in fact we are the moral majority, then our numbers in itself, when we speak, should change things for everyone, for the good. Because we're all brothers and sisters at the end of the day.
You mentioned the off-air discussion about economics, which I want to pursue just a little further. Because what I said was, you know, there are some of the poems that we can't use because there are words in there that we get in trouble for here. And you said, so what's the concern? And I had to admit, yes, it is economic. You know, we could get billed a certain number of dollars by the FCC for every time the S word or the F word comes out on the air. So is the point then that people will not do the right thing because, oh, heavens, I could lose my job, or, you know, they'd make me get out of the neighborhood? Or, I mean, is it that where it gets to, where people just are afraid of money out of their own pockets, and that's why they don't do the right thing?
Well, it was the wrong thing that brought us here, which was economics, cheap labor. Period.
Working in the fields that they wouldn't work in themselves.
That's it. It's just cheap labor. So if it was strong enough for people to do that, to bring another human being over and put them in bondage, then clearly it's strong enough for people, good people, to stay silent in order to have their socioeconomic gains.
And a lot of people were silent. Not only that, but they supported the system as it was. I mean,
that's right.
I mean,
they still do. It's not past tense. Mm-hmm. They still do. I hate when I hear, oh, it's an isolated few. There's no way that an isolated few can hold a nation of minorities down in the face of a majority of good people. The majority of good people must be playing a role.
Dr. Neil Hall is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is a poet and a surgeon. Wow. So many different ways we could go here, but you have talked about what the system that still exists in America is. It's beyond simple racism. It's de facto slavery. Slavery still exists, you're saying.
Right. And it's just not black slavery. It's white slavery also. Because whites are just as much slaves to the big economic system, the one percenters. Okay. So it's just not black slaves. So, yes, we're still living in essence, a slave system. It's tiered, but we're living in it.
Do you think it's getting worse as we talk about income inequality in America and the 1% seems to collect much more to itself? It actually moves up into something like the 0.1%?
Yes, it's getting worse. It's getting worse. I mean, people are not hanging from trees and getting whipped, but, things, you're still being utilized in a very big way to make money for others.
In the reference in Paul from Grants Pass, his question about or his comment about it being generational, and that was one of the questions I had too. About the, it seems like as each generation goes along, racism lessens a little bit. You can't get it completely out of your grandparents or parents, but your kids might have less than you do, for example. But is your point then that with the economic view of racism that it will step backwards if people feel their own livelihoods being threatened?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you look at the Montgomery bus boycott that Martin Luther King was greatly involved in and instrumental in, it was not God coming down, moving the hearts and minds of men to do the right thing. What it was the bus company was losing money. If you look at the Woolworths sit-in in North Carolina. It wasn't that there was a change in hearts and minds that allowed blacks to then sit at the counter to eat with whites. It was that that owner lost $150,000 from that sit-in. That's what made him give in. It wasn't because it was the right thing. It was because he was losing money. So, again, money was the thing that created all this. Collective economics in the hands of good people will be the thing that resolves this issue for all men.
Collective economics?
Collective economics.
Meaning what?
Meaning that my $1 means nothing. My $1 means nothing. But if I take my $1 and add it to your $1, and add it to all the $1 of people with good hearts, and we say to store X, we are not going to buy your goods because of the way you treat blacks or women or anyone. That's going to have a greater impact on that person doing the right thing for all of us.
Does it seem to you like American society is just not quite primed to do those sorts of things anymore? I mean, there are lots of people who wonder sometimes what it takes to get Americans in the streets, as they were so often in the 60s.
I think we put too much faith in politics and religion to do that for us. Sometimes people say to me, well, you ought to think about politics. No. Some of the greatest social changes have been outside of politics, pushing inward. And I think that's where it starts, outside of politics, outside of religion, with good people in the streets doing the right thing.
So the societal pressure builds up first until the people who are in politics and in religion can no longer ignore it.
That's correct. And see, politics is only going to allow itself to move a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right. If it moves too far, then the system is messed up for them to do what they need to do to take care of just themselves.
All right. Much more to talk about with Neil Hall, poet and surgeon. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the surgeon and poet, Dr. Neil Hall. He is, well, like I said, a surgeon and a poet, an ophthalmologist and an eye surgeon as well. He'll be giving his poetry tonight in a session called The Rogue Writes. That'll be at 6 p.m. at Mix in Ashland, the downstairs part of Mix on the plaza. Craig Wright and John Fisher Smith on the bill as well. But you can talk to Dr. Neil Hall here and now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Neil Hall.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have here a quote I wrote down from the back of a book by R.W. Ellison, and it's, "This society is not likely to become free of racism. Thus, it is necessary for Negroes to free themselves by becoming their idea of what a free people should be." And I'd like the doctor's comment on that.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. And how old is that quote?
I would imagine the early 50s, but I don't know.
Okay. And R.W. Ellison? Ralph Ellison, right?
Ralph Waldo Ellison, yes.
All right. Thanks for that. Appreciate it.
So the question was?
The question was what your thoughts are about that that particular statement. Mark, you have it handy with you? Mark, you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, can you give us the quote again?
"This society is not likely to become free of racism. Thus, it is necessary for Negroes to free themselves by becoming their idea of what a free people should be."
All right, so become their own ideal. All right, thanks for that again, Mark.
I think first, what the Negro has to do is learn what freedom is and not what we were taught it should be, but what freedom is. And there'll be a poem that I hope I'll be allowed to read that I think expresses that greatly. But I think for the most part, we don't know what freedom is. And so we must determine that. And for me, economics is intimately raveled in freedom in this country. You need economics to buy freedom and economics to keep freedom. It is the essence of freedom in this country.
All right. Why don't we go to the poem now? We'll get right to that poem on freedom.
Let me see if I can find it.
Okay.
I didn't have it just out.
Right, let me ask you a question while you're digging for that, which is that there's a quote from you here about, "I am convinced that for black Americans, the look of freedom has been more detrimental than no freedom at all."
That's the poem I'm going
to
read.
Is it really? We ended up at the same place. Sorry, I didn't want to give away the punchline.
No, that's all right. Well, you did. No, that's good.
All right, so here we are, talking about freedom in America. And we have it. Okay, The Look of Freedom.
It's called The Look of Freedom. "I'm convinced that for black Americans, the look of freedom has been more detrimental than no freedom at all. I'm convinced we have long since delayed real freedom for the look of freedom, and in the process have lost our ability to distinguish between the two. I'm convinced that for black Americans, perceive integration has succeeded in segregating us not only from ourselves, but from churning black dollars into black financial backbone and wealth building stepping stones into and through mainstream America. We have traded black economic integration for financial segregation, subordination, and domination of black haves and the black have nots. We have traded black economic integration for financial segregation and alienation of black haves from the blacker have-nots. Divided and indistinguishable, we have sold our individual birthrights for consumer rights, to buy white, to look more white, to look like we are indistinguishably white. And in the process, we have lost our ability to distinguish between real freedom and the look of freedom. I'm convinced that for black Americans, the look of freedom has been more detrimental than no freedom at all."
The poem is called The Look of Freedom from Dr. Neil Hall. What do we do then? How do we go for something that is more than just an image of freedom and get real freedom?
Again, I think you must understand the basis of freedom, or the basis for the opportunity to freedom. and that is economics.
Open the door for economics.
Black people must understand it's about economics. All oppressed people, black, white, blue, or green, must understand that their oppression is deeply rooted in economics, and there lies the answer out. There lies the answer out. So if you look at just the black community nationwide, the spending power, this is liquidity, is $917 billion liquidity. If collectively we move that money in directions to say, do the right thing by all men, then we can change the world.
You realize this is a market-based system you're talking about. You make it worth somebody's time financially to be non-racist. They will get there if you put enough financial pressure on them.
That's right. And I don't care about their hearts and mind. I care first about changing behavior. Once we change behavior, then hopefully what we will see is the fallout of changing behavior, that being you and I getting along, you and I being truly brothers, irrespective of our skin color or our gender. Then we may then be in a position to change hearts and minds. But first we must change behaviors. First we must get the hand from around the throat.
So you change the outside first and wait for the inside to catch up?
That's right.
Fake it till you make it. Let us take another call. Here is Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Stephen Hall. Dr. Neil Hall, sorry. I had Stephen on the screen, sorry.
Hi. Well, I've recently become aware of a theory that a friend of my long-term activist gave me that has given me hope in a lot of areas, and I do think that the economic strains on different races of people and people who are struggling is really the lack of freedom, because you can't make choices if you're worried about losing your job, or you can't stand up if you're worried your employer is going to fire you for speaking out. So economic freedom is really true freedom. But the theory is it's the 2-10%. So when 2% of the people stand up against oppression, whatever, you know, any problems, and then the 2% are the starters, the 10% follow, the 90% are the sheeple, the people who will just kind of do what everybody else is doing. So that has given me a lot of hope, because if we can get 10% of the people to stand up for justice, environmental and societal and economic justice, then the rest of the people, I'm reminded of the Hummer Prius thing that happened in L.A. First, the Hummer was really popular. Arnold Schwarzenegger had like 10 of them. Everybody's driving these big SUV Hummers. And then all of a sudden, you know, the environmental awareness kicked in about, you know, global warming and pollution. And so then everybody in L.A. is buying Priuses. So then the rest of the people buy the Priuses. So I just wonder what you thought about that, and I really do appreciate poetry's impact. It distills everything down to the real heart of the matter, and sometimes that's how we wake people up, is through poetry and art. So thanks. And I'll listen on the radio.
All right. Thank you, Pam. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Neil?
Thank you. I'm not a mathematician or anything like that. I just think you speak, and those who will do, and those who will not, will not. I come to believe that you cannot save the whole world. You cannot save everyone, because everyone doesn't know how to be saved, and some don't want to be. And I think if you just speak your truth, whatever it is, and that which you believe in, then you would hope that people will do the right thing. But you're always ready to lead with your economic force first.
Let's take another call. Here's Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Neil Hall.
Hello, this is Julie. Thank you. Dr. Hall, I am speechless. Your words and your background and your piercing into the truth of what needs to be done is something that I would love to see turn into schools everywhere and be brought into the education system. Changing behaviors is really hard for people, especially when they believe they have the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I just think our society, from the poem you stated about how things look, how freedom, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness look. You didn't state those three things. You said freedom. But we've been conditioned to just look at it being presented to us in a certain format that serves the 1%. I know that was your point. So I feel that there has been such a focus and almost a devotional worship to the pursuit of happiness that it's been at the expense and exploitation of life and liberty. Oh. And the last thing I want to say is we need to really thank Black American race of people, not as a separate people, but as people who struggled to achieve a level of freedom and independence and equality for so many years. And they've shown us the way, you have shown us the way, historically, of how hard-won that is. And it seems to all of us, and I think we're afraid we're losing ground. And we need to learn together to regain the ground and build it into our country and our world properly. So I join your forces, and I hope we can reunite our United States with these values, with a lot more awareness from lessons learned. And I thank you so much for your background and your willingness to stay with what you could do in your life and bring it forth to this point. And I think we need to grab the baton and run the race.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Beautiful words, just beautiful from you. But I want to make sure that everyone understands that this is just not a Black issue. This is a human issue. This is an issue that belongs to all of us. I cannot speak about, in great detail, the issues with respect to women because I am not a woman. I can only speak from the perspective of a Black man in this country, but many of the things that we experience overlap. And so when I speak from my perspective, I speak for all of us, all of us. It is not just a Black issue. It is a human issue. It's all our issues, and we must all work together to solve them.
On that count, Stephen and Eugene sent an email in, and he says he's proposed an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. A citizen shall be known as an American. He says, try this. The next time you want to describe someone as an African-American, refuse to allow yourself to use a racial identifier of any sort. Force yourself to say American and only American as the identifier. Believe me, it is hard to do, very hard. And that describes the problem and the solution. We will never be one in deeds until we are one in words first. That from Stephen and Eugene. Thoughts?
One in heart and mind before words.
In heart and mind, but your point is you can't get the hearts and minds before you get the economic stuff
lined
up.
And so you change the behavior.
Mm-hmm. Change the behavior first.
Just change the behavior. But this, you know, call me something different, but think me the same. It's just a game that you're playing with yourself.
Just changes the labels.
Just changes the label. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the, oh, we can't say nigger, but we can say N-word. And so to me, if you thought enough about the N-word or nigger, not to say nigger, but to say N-word, then you thought enough about nigger that you should have went on and just said nigger. Because to me, as an African-American, there is but a fine line between N-word and nigger. So you might as well just say nigger.
One is a pillowcase that hides the other.
That's
we know
right.
What pillowcases have been used for in this country.
Yeah.
How do you manage to find time for the poetry and to continue your medical practice?
Because I'm cutting down on the medical practice so I can write. I love writing, and that's what drives me. And that's what I'm going to do.
And so, do you put time, two, 3 days in at the office still, or is it?
Yeah, that's about it, about 2 to 3 days. And I work everything around writing in the gym.
Mm-hmm. Writing, yeah. I was going to say, you still look like an athlete, by all means. So the event is called The Rogue Rights. It features Dr. Neil Hall, who you've been listening to in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange, Craig Wright, and John Fisher Smith. It's at 6 o'clock tonight at Mix, M-I-X in Ashland. It's at the corner of the plaza as you first come into it in Ashland. It's the downstairs portion. It used to be known as Munchies in Ashland, right? Right? Okay. Christina Ammon set this up, the event tonight, and also set up the appearance of Dr. Neil Hall here on the Jefferson Exchange. Neil, thank you so much for being here. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. I loved it. Thank you, everyone.
All right. Take care. And that'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We do provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to the folks behind one of Oregon's health insurance co-ops. That'll be in our first hour. It'll take up the whole first hour. We are planning a discussion about fires and the responses to fires around the region in hour number two of the Jefferson Exchange. That's all tomorrow on the Exchange. The producer of the Jefferson Exchange is Charlotte Duren. She's also working the controls today. Our student assistant is Megan Mercier. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Have a great day.